Good morning. I'd like to call the Senate Education Committee to order at 8 a.m. Today is Monday, February 27th, 2017. Thank you for those assisting us. Please do what you do with your in the morning with your cell phones here in the building. And we are going to have a presentation. This may be a shorter meeting than we've had in the past, but I think it's going to be an important one. Every committee hearing we have is important, and it just keeps increasing the body of knowledge that we have to make our decisions. And today we're going to look at virtual education from the IT perspective. And we'll have two gentlemen with the Anchorage School District who have asked to speak from their personal experience rather than on behalf of the Anchorage School District. Both Pete LaFrance and Andy Chaloup have a lot of experience working with virtual education. We'll be speaking about this issue from both the management and staff levels of an organization. They may also provide some insight into what they believe it takes for a teacher as far as the difference in teaching in a virtual classroom as opposed to a live classroom. I know I had a conversation with Mr. LaFrance about that, so I'm hoping he will enlighten us on that topic. So with that, I'm going to invite Pete LaFrance to begin your testimony. Good morning, Pete. If you'd introduce yourself for the record and your affiliation, although I know today, even though the Anchorage School District, I believe, has okayed your speaking, you're giving your personal views in your as your work has taught you. Good morning.
That's correct. Good morning, Senator Hughes. I would like to thank you very sincerely for the invitation to speak to you all and thank the rest of the senators for your work on such an important topic. My name is Pete LaFrance. I live at 720 Cascade Court in Palmer, Alaska. And I guess I would start off by saying, you know, we all have an occupation, you know, U.S. senators, myself as a teacher. And when we move into the virtual world, it really is a big step. It really is a big change for people. So I guess as we discuss this topic, I invite you all to come at it from your own perspective and imagine whatever jobs or industry you came from to have a big switch thrown and be asked to perform the job just really through a different medium. And I think that's always helpful to keep in mind.
Pete, I'm going to interrupt you for just a minute because I just realized I didn't take the roll. And that's one of the duties. Before the secretary gives me the evil eye, which actually she would never do. But this morning we have Senator Stevens and Senator Beckage and myself. Senator Geisel is excused. And Senator Coghill is also excused. So go ahead and proceed, Pete.
Okay. Thank you. And I don't have a formal anything prepared. I was just going to just discuss some of my own experiences quite briefly, and then if you have any questions, please interrupt me at any time. And because I find there's a little bit of beauty here as I'm calling in to be virtually present at the meeting, and we're experiencing some of those, not frustrations, but some of those issues of communication and interacting with someone virtually. So my experience, I've been a teacher since about the year 2000, and I was a high school biology teacher. I moved into computers almost immediately and technology. I worked at a private school near Mexico City where I taught and used and helped teachers use technology. I worked at a charter school in Minnesota where I was the director of technology there. And that was a project-based charter school, and then I was also the director of technology at the International School of Luxembourg before moving back to Alaska. And now I work as a technology collaborator at Mirror Lake Middle School, which means I help teachers use technology effectively. And I do that part-time, and I also teach a video production class as well. So as I see it, I mean, when we think of education, it's a very intimate experience, right? I mean, we all hopefully have memories of connecting with teachers on a level that went beyond the curriculum. And when we move into the virtual world, I think one of the biggest challenges is to open those doors for those interpersonal connections, really what I see as the heart of a good education across a very different medium. And so we're asking teachers to facilitate almost a traditional relationship in a very different way. And I think anyone who uses social media effectively knows that you can achieve this, but I have seen many instances where you have a brilliant, absolutely brilliant classroom teacher that doesn't make the transition to virtual learning, and that can be for any number of reasons. So I think, you know, I've been asked to speak about teacher training and my perspective kind of as a boots on the ground. I think teacher training is very much like, you know, teaching students. It all, at some degree, has to be personal and all has to be differentiated. I think the barriers for one teacher to be effective virtually can be very different from a different teacher. And so with that understanding, I think as we open this door in Alaska and we start to investigate this path more on a broad scale, I think our teacher training program really is the most important component of this, because there are many instances where districts and their studies showing that districts, when they institute technology, the biggest predictor as to whether they'll fail or succeed is that teacher training component. And the problem with that is that the teacher training component is really difficult because it has to be differentiated. Like, for instance, I've got teachers at Mirror Lake here that have jumped in the virtual world using, like, Google Classroom seems to be the platform that we've adopted most readily. And they've jumped in it, they're communicating with students at home, they're giving assignments, they're collecting assignments, and it's not necessarily predictable which teachers will gravitate towards using that program successfully. And so really, it's one of the training components is this just-in-time technology, or just-in-time training, which is if a teacher has a problem, someone is there to address that and to help them out with that. So I think that's one component. Also, another component is, of course, laying the groundwork to ensure that the expectations of the teacher are appropriate and understood. Because it really takes, I think it takes a lot more effort, oddly, paradoxically maybe, to engage a student electronically via these different mediums in an appropriate way and to move them in the correct direction. So I think there's a lot of benefits and challenges, and as I said, I'm excited to go down this road, and I think a measured approach in the teacher training component is important. And certainly having concrete goals for both the training program and the teachers, and a kind of a scaffolding support approach for teachers so that they can get familiar with the tools, and then as they're more familiar, then we can remove some of those supports. But I hope I'm making sense. I don't like to talk this much, so.
You're doing a great.
That was the kind of the bulk of what I wanted to say, and I guess if there's any questions, I'd be happy to take those.
You're doing a great job, Pete, and I see members writing down things which I'm guessing are questions. So, Senator Bekich, did you have a question?
I did. Pete, this is Tom Bekich, and glad to have you on the line. One of the things that came up in the discussions, I get lost in the time, Senator. I think it was last week, but it might have been a week ago Friday. We had some folks call in from New York and some folks call in from Florida and talk about their particular approach to virtual education. In each case, they really talked about really their programming seemed to be an expansion of availability to students. You know, when you're dealing with restricted budgets or you're dealing with limitations on a budget, the first thing that seems to suffer is the availability of offerings for students. You've articulated that one of the things that's important is to have a teacher there who kind of translates, but do you see the advantage in virtual education of expanding the availability for kids? Is that something that are you seeing more course availability open to your to kids as a result of the use of technology?
Yeah, thank you for the question, Senator Bekich. I think it's a very good one, and the short answer is yes. And we saw this especially in Luxembourg, where we had the student body, by and large, is very high achieving. And to offer those specialty courses that, really look more like college courses to those higher achieving students, we turned to the virtual world. So we couldn't, we didn't have a Chinese teacher. But in my final year at school, we were able to offer Chinese to students because we were able to do it virtually. And so, yeah, that is, I would say, a huge benefit to opening this door. But one of the cautions, I think, that come with that is, I think, reaching the high-achieving students. I mean, we all know students, know people that, you know, you kind of put them anywhere and they were able to learn, you know. And I think reaching those lower-achieving students, or the students that struggle with engagement or, you know, any number of things, I think it becomes more difficult to offer them a wide range of courses unless we crack this nut of really figuring out how to engage them virtually. But essentially, to answer your question, yeah, the course offerings can go through the roof, definitely.
Follow-up, Senator Begich?
Yes, and I think a total of three follow-ups, and I'll try to keep them fairly brief.
Go ahead.
The one of the things that came up in another one of the hearings, one of the joint hearings that we did here, was the discussion of what does a teacher need to know now to be able to incorporate technology in the classrooms. And I think part of our belief here was that it would be helpful if the university was teaching teachers how to teach with technology a little bit more effectively. Are you aware of, or are you familiar with, any kind of courses that might be available at the college level that we could, you know, sort of pass on or identify that would be helpful to teachers so that they can integrate technology more effectively into their classrooms by developing their own skill sets? Are there things we can be doing now, whether as an in-service or as a part of our teacher instruction at the very beginning of a teacher's career?
That's another great question. Thank you, Senator Begich. I got my master's degree in education administration from Michigan State University, and at the time they had offered a master's degree in education technology. And some of the courses they offered, I think, would be absolutely fantastic for just about any teacher, you know, to kind of delve into these theories of electronic communication. And you know, I keep coming back to that connection with students, because I think that's really the most important thing. And the good teachers have that, you know, at an intuitive level in the classroom. And I think a good teacher in the virtual world, it might not be intuitive, but you know, giving them a sandbox, if you will, to explore connecting with students virtually, I think is absolutely important. And so the Anchorage School District offers a program called iSchool, which is, you know, virtual classes. And I did the teacher training for iSchool a couple years ago, just because I wanted to see what it was all about. And I think that laid the groundwork for the technology. But part of the problem with that is technology always changes. You know, I mean, you can't, if most of us use Facebook, you know that, you know, Facebook looks different from year to year, sometimes even from month to month. And they make continual changes. And I think creating those habits of mind in teachers, or helping the teachers get to the point where they see their technology skills not as a fixed goal, but as a continually evolving process, really, is also important. So I think I'm not doing a very good job of answering your question, but I think having continual exposure to those tools is important, as well as, you know, showing models of it done effectively. Because I know I've taken college courses virtually that were exceptionally good and exceptionally poor. And I think when I talk to teachers on this issue, many of them, you know, talk about those virtual courses they took and they didn't have a good experience. And so I think even as far as training goes, having someone model how it can be done effectively for them is really important. So I would think that even delivering like a traditional, you know, traditional teacher improvement course electronically in an effective manner would be really a good way to introduce folks into using these tools. So my only experience is with Michigan State as far as college courses taught for teachers, but I think your instinct is absolutely right. We have to get better at preparing teachers for this, because this really is the reality of education. And certainly a conversation with UAA teacher education program, I think, would be very beneficial for the future of the teachers of Alaska.
Senator Begich is going to continue, but I just want to make a comment. While you were speaking, I was picturing a professional development course to be offered virtually, where it would be demonstrated how not to do this, where everybody would be bored out of their minds, and then follow it with presenting the same material, doing it effectively. So, Senator Begich, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think I got also another image, which was the learning by doing, which we, of course, all want to adopt. But my last two questions I'll combine in one, and it's about really students and how they learn. In conversations I had with Superintendent Dan Walker from the lower Kuskokwim School District, he described levels of readiness for when it's most appropriate to expose kids to substantial amounts of virtual learning. He tends to start at, you know, he does a preschool program, preps his students, gets them into the classroom, generally has a lot of teacher interaction at the younger ages. He's citing brain development when he does that, you know, the basis of brain development. And then as they get older into the, and you're at Mirror Lake, so you have some experience with older kids as well. As the kids get older, it integrates more and more technology learning. And you also mentioned, you know, there are some kids who just simply can't learn that way. I think you were implying that, and that they learn at different speeds or different levels. So taking sort of the readiness question about brain development in youth, and then the secondary question about what kind of a classroom process works best, you know, maybe take a stab at when you think it's most appropriate to introduce different levels of technology. And again, I'm not expecting you to be the expert in this, Pete. I'm expecting, if you have an answer to it, that'd be helpful to us, I think, to know sort of where that brain development level piece is when it's most effective to do this kind of learning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, and I thank you very much again for Senator Begich for the question. I think this is a really interesting one because it does come down to, you know, the biology of brain development and, you know, what is best for the child. Is it appropriate to, you know, have a kindergartner sitting 8 hours in front of a screen? I think all of us intuitively would say, you know, that just feels wrong. And I think it is. And previously what we would do is at the International School of Luxembourg, we had computers in all the classroom, four computers, and we really used the computers to differentiate instruction. So in a classroom of, you know, 20 students, we would have four computers, so a fifth of the class would be working on computers, and another station, the students would be working on something else, another station, and the students would rotate through. So they would get a taste of it, but it wasn't predominantly where the students were interacting with the curriculum. And, you know, even teaching something like keyboarding so the students can use these tools effectively demands a substantial amount of time, but, you know, where do you begin to introduce that skill to students, I think, is a difficult question. And so, in my experience, I think at the elementary level, it really is, you know, kind of a slow introduction. And, you know, as the students mature, the content that they can access electronically deepens, and so it becomes less, you know, learning how to use this tool in front of them, and as opposed to engaging with the curriculum. And so I think for me, by fourth grade, the students were able to create using technology. And that I think is a big goal for us, is to kind of unlock the potential of this tool for the students. And instead of just having them consume curriculum, having them create and use their, you know, use their brains to make something novel and creative. And that can be, you know, a video project, that can be an essay, that can be any number of things. But to me, I really saw kind of a watershed moment right around fourth grade where the students were able to do things at kind of a higher level. And then in middle school, I think many of the skills, hopefully, are there for the students to create across multiple media and really delve into projects more deeply and get a bigger meaning from the curriculum than they would if they were just, you know, clicking through. I think a huge component here, and obviously, you know, I know you guys are hearing from a lot of people, and you're bringing your own expertise to the table. But I think parents play such a role in the elementary grades, especially. And I think we'd be remiss if we didn't acknowledge that. If the expectation was to deliver content electronically to elementary students, then the training for parents would really need to be there, because teachers go to such lengths to create an appropriate learning environment for students that without that in a home, even if they're on a computer with headphones on, I really think we have to help parents understand how we can help their students be successful in this model. So that was kind of a long, rambling, quasi-answer to your question, Senator Baggage, but I think that kind of sums up my understanding of the topic.
Thank you.
Senator Stevens.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, we've heard some exciting things in the last few days about virtual education. One thing I wanted to have you talk about, if you would, is... I think a lot of folks look at virtual ed as a cost-saving means of educating students. I'm not sure that's true, and what you've said about always having someone there if there's a problem in the classroom, that it takes more than the teacher to deliver these. So would you talk about that? Also the issue of computers, of course, we know that we need more computers in the classroom. Do you see this as an enhanced form of education, or do you see it as a cost saving, which I think I know the answer to, but I'd appreciate you sort of addressing that a bit if you would.
Thank you, Senator Stevens. I think it's a very good question as well. And I've wrestled with this a lot, it particularly as I noted, I was director of technology, so I manage the technology budget at the International School of Luxembourg, and as we implemented programs, oftentimes I'd meet with the board, and they'd say, like, their expectation was very different from folks in the school, because their expectation was the bottom line, because you often see that in industry, right? You say, we brought in this new technology, and while the initial outlay might have been more expensive, the cost savings are there. You can see it. Education, I think it's more difficult to go into programs like this with cost savings as being the primary objective. There are ways you can do it. You know, don't get me wrong. We could contract a school. I think there's a huge school in Florida that's just kind of like they have massive classes, students enroll, and it's cheaper for the district. However, the quality of education isn't there, and it's certainly not localized to the student's experience, and I think you lose a lot. So I think, we're all very aware of the state of Alaska's budget, and, teachers especially go into this with an understanding that, things are going to look different. But with that said, programs like this, I haven't seen to cost less if they're really done well initially. I think once that bar is raised and teachers are comfortable with the technology, then, and, we can plug into other resources and the students are comfortable with learning in a blended environment or, an entirely digital environment, then possibly we might see some cost savings. But I would be skeptical. I would ask to see numbers in advance for both, the equipment outlay, training programs that were set up, and then, staffing numbers, how many students can a teacher in an environment like this serve before I would jump on it as a cost savings program. So I think my focus has always been on maintaining the quality of education, and that's been a luxury that I've had in my previous positions. If we're doing this strictly for cost savings, then I think we have to be very, very diligent to ensure that, that the quality remains high. So I hope that answered your question, Sandra.
Thanks, Pete. I appreciate your perspective. And if I could ask one more question on a different subject. I'm thinking of my children growing up a few decades ago, and at that time, I remember all the readings I had. Well, you need to make sure you have lots of books in the house, lots of magazines, and the difference between kids that often don't succeed and those that do is the fact that their parents were comfortable with books and they had lots of reading material in their homes. Now today, what I'm hearing you saying is that we have to educate the parents, and I think you're right. How do we educate the parents to be supportive of their children in this new virtual world, training parents? That's an interesting thought. I guess my real concern is a kid in a village doing poorly in front of a teacher is going to have trouble doing better in front of a computer. I guess that's sort of the bottom line of what I'm thinking about. So how do we pay a lot of attention to the excellent students, to the motivated students, that students you couldn't stop if you wanted to, but how do we reach the lower achievers? How do we reach the unmotivated student? How can we do that with use of technology?
Yeah, that Senator, is the million-dollar question, truly. And it's funny because some students gravitate towards technology. I've had some traditionally lower achieving students in the classroom that, you know, you give them a computer and it just works for them. But, you know, I think the students you're speaking about are those really difficult to engage students, and that could be for any number of reasons. I won't speculate. And without that teacher in the classroom, or without that teacher in front of them, it is difficult to determine engagement. It really is. You know, and oftentimes virtual education has a, you know, video chat piece. And, you know, where you might, in fact, get your whole class together, providing the internet connection is good enough, you know. And so each person can see each person. So even if you're not face-to-face, at least it's a video link. And I think that can help. But, you know, having a student come in the door at 8 a.m. in the morning and leave at 4 o'clock, you have a much bigger snapshot into the realities that that student is going through than, you know, even a video chat for an hour a day or whatever it might be. You know, and in things that you can't see over the computer, like how the student smells. I mean, it sounds weird, but that is a really powerful indicator of how things are going for students at home. And so I think there's a lot of unanswered questions, absolutely. And I think you tapped into the biggest one, is how do you motivate the student that, you know, on the surface seems to not care? And I sincerely wish I had the answer or a better answer to that question. I think we can try to reach them via different modalities. We can make sure that they have room to be creative, to create novel things, to explore their own interests. I think all those are things that we can do. But oftentimes with, you know, small percentage of students, you run into that wall. And I think classroom teachers run into that wall in a physical setting, and they have a much larger skill set to draw on to try and reach that student. Virtually, you know, you can try and reach that student, but you might not have all those tools available. And so it is a bigger challenge, I think, for certain students.
Thank you, Pete. I appreciate your candor. Thank you. Matt.
Thank you. Based on what you were just saying, I just want to make a few comments. I do think that there's a lot of initial upfront cost. I do think we need to look at this as a way of increasing the quality of education by increasing the access to some great teachers across the state and access to more course offerings, and doing that economically, I guess. And so as far as the cost savings, time would tell. But I wanted to ask you, Pete, in regard to the small rural schools, and we have many in our state, if you had We'll take an at ease here. All right, we're back on the record and in the Senate Education Committee, and we lost connection with Pete LaFrance, which is par for the course when we're talking about virtual education, so we'll understand what may happen to students from time to time. But, oh, is Pete back on now? Yes, he is. So, Pete, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, well, I will continue my question. So I'd like you to think, you have widespread experience around the globe, so I want you to imagine a small school in rural Alaska where you have a school of 25 and you have a teacher that's tasked with multiple grades and has been trained in particular content areas, but not all content areas, and so we're asking that teacher virtually impossible to be an expert in all those areas and all those grade levels. That's really a big focus of mine, is trying to help those students gain access to great teachers across the state and to more course offerings. If we talk about synchronous virtual two-way education as opposed to asynchronous, so two-way virtual synchronous, where we actually have a live teacher in the virtual classroom with the students, I want you to comment on that in regard to what we might consider low-achieving students. And I have noticed and I have read that you mentioned it too. Sometimes low-achieving students are actually, they like the technology and they gravitate towards it, and where they might be mischievous and wandering and in a live classroom when a teacher is up at the board talking and explaining things, they really get into the technology and the back and forth that way. So I'm just wondering if you think there's potential to reach those students, and what if the teacher is not in the classroom, the teacher's beaming in from another location, what kind of support you think would be needed in the room? I was speaking with a commissioner, and we've been talking about if you had very talented instructional aides from the local village that grew up there, knew the kids, very bright, capable individuals. If you had an instructional aide in the room with that student, the great teacher beaming in from miles away, do you think that might work? And then also I wanted to ask you just the technical part. Do you need a technical aide at each site as well? I imagine you do. And so, and how many classrooms could a technical aide handle at once to make sure everything is running smoothly? So just envision with me for a moment that rural school setting and how, if we could reach the broad spectrum of students, the different types of students, if that could be successful compared to what we're able to offer them now. And I might throw in there right now, we learned last week that the estimated, this is very just an estimate, turnover cost per teacher is about $50,000, and where the turnover rate in villages, in some villages, is quite high. And so that, just think about that in comparison to what we might be offering and if you think we could be successful.
Thank you for the question, Denise. I think that that's really an important scenario to think about. And I think I think that this model could work very well in a situation like that, absolutely. You know, and I think the picture you're painting is maybe a really effective way to deliver an engaging curriculum to a really probably very diverse group of students. You know, and having that local, those local aides that know the students in the classroom while tapping, using the technology to tap resources that might not be available in the village, you know, is brilliant. And it could, I think that model could be very successful. And I think you highlighted some things that, you know, would need to be addressed, of course. As far as the tech aids go, if the technology, if the bandwidth is there, if, you know, the electricity is stable, which I know can all be question marks in many of these villages, then I think the technology has gotten reliable enough to where the tech support isn't as huge of a component as it was even 5 years ago. I mean, we have a, let me just think about Mirror Lake here. We've got probably 300 computers, 200 and some. And, you know, we have one part-time tech that services those. So it's not as demanding as it once was, providing the internet is stable. And that's generally the biggest issue. I think you also hit on something important here as well, in that sometimes these students that, you know, don't seem to be able to pay attention in classroom are simply ones that aren't challenged enough. You know, and the thing about technology delivered instruction is that really it opens the door for challenges that might not be present in the classroom for students that should be, you know, quote unquote high achieving, but just aren't quite there because, you know, they're messing around in the classroom or whatever, or the teachers working with students that are struggling and doesn't have the time to continually throw appropriate level challenges at that student. But if you can tap that student into, you know, technology-based learning, and there's, you know, an expert on the other side that's really working to challenge them, or even they're enrolled in a course that's more challenging, I think that is a good model. And that charter school I worked at was project-based, so like I was an advisor, kind of in this scenario you're painting, really, and I had 18 students, and my job was to kind of work with them to develop projects that would challenge them appropriately. And it was amazing that what would happen when you were able to hit a student in their zone of proximal development, you know, right where they needed to be challenged, and the challenge was appropriate. Some of those kids just really opened up, and they were able to go places, educationally speaking, that, you know, their parents were blown away by even. So I do absolutely think that instruction, kind of as you laid out the scenario, could certainly be functional and effective and better. You know?
Thank you, Pete. I have another question just about when Senator Stevens brought up the having books in the home and magazines and encouraging that in the home environment and educating parents. I was wondering whether children are so curious and they have questions, you know, why this, why that, how does this work? Do you see children now that when they have this kind of curiosity that they're being directed to Google it, and so that we might actually get some of these curious children, instead of, you know, just asking a question that an adult might not have the information, that they're actually going and seeking out the information and reading more because of that?
Yeah, I would say yes. And and a big component of that I think many schools have really stepped up on is, you know, information literacy. How do students determine what information they're consuming is good or bad? But I absolutely agree. I think students are able to satiate their curiosity more independently. You know, a lot of times there's a focus on technology, you know, making lazy people, we have all the answers at our fingertips, but I think it does demand a level of literacy and information awareness that are essential tools for navigating modern society. I'm inclined to agree with you. I think it's exciting, you know, and we just need to make sure the kids have the tools to digest this information in appropriate ways.
All right, we're going to take one more question for Senator Begich and one from Senator Stevens, and then we're going to move on to Andrew Chaloup. So, Senator Begich.
Mine is less a question, just sort of building off the comments Mr. LaFrance just made and that you made, Madam Chair. One of the things, again, and Dan Walker discussed with me was as they develop their broadband capacity and they're hoping for fiber optic and other kinds of things to lower the costs, They are trying to, in the small village setting, connect up their small villages so that the child that has that curiosity isn't limited to the school. They can actually explore that curiosity in the home as well, which is also a way of bringing the parent up. So I think there's a model there. I want to watch as it develops. But there's a model there that might be very interesting and kind of play both into what Mr. LaFrance is talking about in terms of creating that curiosity, and that you're talking about in small village and curiosity and the whole family piece. So I just thought I'd pass that on.
Thank you. I'm hoping it will increase the conversation and the type of topics discussed in the home. I had a funny experience not too long ago. I was in an Uber vehicle, and I asked what the population of the city was where I was visiting. And the guy, I felt like it was a little bit rude. And he says, "You've got a smartphone, look it up." So hopefully the parents will engage in a positive way with their students on that. Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, this is probably a question impossible to answer, but, you know, I think about my experience, 2.5 years a university professor, and then the last 17 here in the legislature. I've seen enormous changes, almost on an annual basis. We buy computers regularly here to replace old computers. Things are changing so quickly. If you were to look into the future, sort of, where are we going in technology? Obviously, you will not be doing what you're doing right now with the same equipment for the next 20 years. What do you see happening in terms of the future of virtual education?
I think I could speak for hours on that, but I won't bore you with that. I think where it's the most important is, we're starting to see really a diffusion into multiple different devices. And I think Senator Hughes' comment about the Uber driver is spot on. You know, it's technology, number one, is getting more personal. It's ubiquitous. It's always on us. It's getting to the point where it's everywhere. You know, we carry in our pockets devices that, you know, would shame computers from 10 years ago. And I think that will definitely continue. You know, the expectation that students have is that there will be access to the internet, period. You know, and that can look like many different things, but it will be there, and it's a resource for them that they don't anticipate ever going away, and I certainly hope it doesn't. And I think the good news is, on the technology side, we've started to see devices come in like Chromebooks, for instance, that run the Chrome operating system, which is basically, you can think of it as an operating system almost in the cloud, right? So these devices are much less demanding. They can run off on old machines. They can run on machines that don't have the firepower that a full Windows or Mac OS operating system might need. And the good news for schools is that those machines cost about $200. So now instead of a computer lab for a school, we can talk about getting devices in the hands of every single student. Not that they'll be used all the time, you know, per se, but they can be used at those inappropriate times. And those moments where, and I remember this in the classroom, where having that technology there would enable spontaneity that is wonderful. You know, and I think that's where it's going. I think this idea of computer labs is done. I think this idea of, even set workstations is done. I think it's all about accessing curriculum, accessing content through whatever device is most appropriate for that content. And that might be a student's phone, that might be a tablet, that might be a full-blown big screen workstation, depending on what the student's needs are. But I think that with the ubiquity of devices, it's going to be, I hope, less about the technology, less about the physical technology that's there, and more about just getting to that content. And I think the Chromebooks, the Chrome operating system, is kind of an initial foray into that thinking. Because all of a sudden, to manage, you know, a student classroom with computers, it's not a big onerous task. You don't have to re-image computers, and you don't have to do this and do that. You just log into the internet, and you can manage the computers from a Google portal. And you know, teachers can do that, really, if they have the tool. So I think it's getting easier, it's getting better. And I think it's going to get more appropriate based on the content the student is going to interact with. But I hope that answers your question, Senator Stevens.
Thank you very much, Pete. That was an excellent answer, and obviously I have to learn something about Chromebooks.
Yeah, and thank you very much, Pete. I was thinking 20 years, the teachers beaming in from a couple hundred miles away also might appear in hologram form. Who knows?
Absolutely.
So thank you very much. It's been very helpful and informative, and love to hear from boots on the ground. And next up is Andrew Chaloup. Andrew, I imagine you've been listening in, so if you could introduce yourself and add what you believe would be important for the committee to consider as we look at this possibility for Alaska.
Thank you, Senators. Yes, my name is Andrew Chaloup. I'm currently one of the IT and Educational Technology Directors in the Anchorage School District, although today I'm kind of coming in representing a little more of probably previous experience. We're currently working on our digital roadmap for our district, but before I moved here from Arizona, I was actually in charge of all of our virtual and blended learning schools and then several other programs to kind of bring our teaching staff kind of up into sort of what we call digital transition or digital convergence. So I'm lucky enough I get to work with Pete once in a while, so I did appreciate the conversation. I kind of had three main things that from more of a district perspective or that, you know, 30,000-foot view always came into consideration as we were looking at virtual schooling. Number one was the access. Obviously, that has been mentioned, but really two key things go along with that access, and that is device and bandwidth. That issue keeps coming up. But as we start to look at more and more powerful online learning tools, I think the greatest limiter in Alaska right now is our bandwidth. And then two is that appropriate course materials. And so Pete kind of alluded to this a little bit, but there's as you go further down the grade level range in the kindergarten versus up to high school, there's definitely strong materials in that middle school to high school range. There's decent materials in the intermediate grade levels, which is kind of like that third through fifth. But as we start getting into those lower grade levels, there's really not sort of independent kind of study types of practices. So there's some companies that are out there working on that, but it's definitely an area of weakness. So that's something that definitely would have to be considered. The second key thing, I think, that always becomes a tricky conversation, and it has in every program I've ever worked with digital, is that competency-based idea versus the experience-based. And so one of the things that always comes up in virtual education is that balance point between there are courses that really are, that lend themselves to being competency driven. In other words, if I'm doing an Algebra 1 course, you can give me a clear set of objectives and I can meet those objectives, improve my ability to do those mathematical concepts, or I can't. It's very black and white. Now, where that gets a lot trickier is as you start getting into some of the humanities or even writing courses, where there's a lot more performance tasks involved. And that's not to be, you know, that is true also of STEM courses. But it's really, what is that balance point between competency-based versus performance-based? Obviously, the competency-based piece is interesting because you can kind of do away with that traditional Carnegie unit idea of course competency or even credit acquisition. And that's a critical piece at really recognizing the full value of virtual education is sort of that idea that based on competency, you're ready to progress as opposed to seat time, right? That's a big issue. That comes up from the personalization aspect. It also comes up potentially from a cost savings aspect, right? The third piece, and I think you guys talked about this a little bit, really is that student support model. And what are successful student support models when you're looking at virtual education? I saw a big switch in my time in virtual education from kind of the, what really is that, at least when I last looked at it, sort of that Florida virtual school where you still have a teacher involved. A lot of times it's still somewhat synchronized as far as the course content goes. And then you started seeing a lot of other companies kind of come in. You had Apex Learning, you had Edgenuity, and these were some of those more competency-based programs. And what you saw was this bifurcation of duties when it came to teaching. And so what you saw was you had content experts available on demand for the students. So if I was working on calculus and I was struggling on a particular problem, I could hit a button and immediately be connected to a calculus tutor for that particular concept area. But throughout my course, what became very apparent was that I needed a success coach. And so that's a term that's been used by a variety of different groups. But it's that idea that, you know, you need those content area experts, but you also need somebody who's almost a caseworker to support that student through that online learning experience. Because a typical traditional classroom teacher kind of fulfills both roles. They're both content experts, and they're there to motivate, support, encourage that student. And so what we found was, especially as we started going to more of those self-driven, asynchronous types of learning experiences, that you really needed that success coach there to connect with the student, to keep them engaged in their learning, and sometimes even to provide context of what they were learning and why. And so that was kind of the three biggies that I was kind of thinking about. If you'd like, I can either answer some quick questions about that, or I actually took notes as you guys were asking Pete some questions, and I can kind of give you a little bit of my thoughts around those questions that came up.
Well, you could do that. We'll take questions, too, but I want to just ask one real quick because you just the last item you mentioned was the success coach, and you heard me describe what could possibly take place in a rural school if we moved to this model. Do you think the instructional aide could be that success coach that you're talking about? What kind of training would that success coach need to have?
That's a great question. So I do think they can. So we ran multiple different models. Our blended learning model that I was experienced with, it was modeled off the Carpe Diem model out of Yuma, Arizona. I don't know if you're familiar with them or not. They were one of the first sort of large-scale blended learning charter schools in Arizona. We used a lot of paraprofessional or classified staff to really help keep the kids moving through the curriculum, checking in on them. The one thing you would still want, though, and it doesn't have to be, you know, super small. This is somebody who can have, you know, 120, 150 students attached to them. You still want almost like that counselor-type person as well, though, who can help address sort of the individual needs of the students. So I think they could. I think it depends on the size, right? And so you had mentioned sort of small rural schools with, you know, 25, 30 kids max. I mean, I think it's a very interesting idea. I think they're going to bring a lot of the cultural context and other pieces, so the realities of the village or the rural area, in with those students. So I think it's a compelling model. They're going to, in my mind, would fit somewhere, you know, definitely needing a few years of sort of a prep to really be prepared for that role of how do you support that, how do you support the parents, how do you support the students.
Yes, thank you, absolutely. So questions. Senator Stevens, do you have one?
This has been a fascinating discussion, Senator, and I really appreciate you doing this. I guess I have a question that I don't want to sound insensitive, but how do we provide an education to people that want to remain in a subsistence lifestyle? I mean, That's a problem, isn't it? I mean, as president of my school board, I went to a small village, and an elderly man said, you've got to stop educating our kids, because as soon as you educate them, they leave, and we want people to stay in our village. So I don't really know even if there's a question there, but how do we deal with a subsistence lifestyle and distance learning at the same time? I mean, are we going to see a reduction in the population in these small villages? I mean, is that the future of Alaska? I don't know even what my question is, but do you have any reflection on that at all?
Well, I do a little bit. You know, I think it's a valid point that many people have brought up over and over again, and there's a couple thoughts I have to that. So one is, I've been fortunate enough to, when I did my master's program in northern Arizona, I was an online program, and one of my peers actually was from the Navajo Reservation. And what was interesting about his experience was that he was doing educational technology, and he actually owns a technology company now, Navajo Innovations. They actually created a translator for the Navajo language on Android. It was kind of interesting. But his whole point was that technology could and would actually enable him to stay on the reservation and actually have a lifestyle that, you know, was kind of modern, but also embraced parts of his traditional culture. And so, you know, that's one of the things that I've always been deeply intrigued by. There's a lot of people out there. You ask that bigger question, where are we going to be in 20 years? Well, depending on who you talk to, right, they sort of say that, artificial intelligence is going to pretty much put us all out of jobs, and that really the people who are going to be most well-equipped for the modern world are going to be those deep thinkers and artists and other types of people. And so it kind of begs that interesting question of, that there's a lot of traditional understandings around the world, around philosophy, around art, and so how do you incorporate that? You know, if you have the technology to communicate, you can be anywhere in the world and still produce. I know that's kind of like a weird sort of roundabout way to get here, but I think the key there is, you know, two things. One, the traditional understandings piece becomes very problematic when you talk about those large-scale courses. So when you're thinking of like an adaptive learning system, that's going to be geared very much towards sort of a typical understanding of the world in those types of pieces. And I would agree that might be problematic in the context of an Alaska Native village. But what's interesting is the opposite could be true as well, where I know some of those groups that have been working on online education in the state for a while, they could actually develop personalized courses that are geared with sort of more of a native understanding of the world as part of their coursework and still address some of the same academic challenges we're trying to get to. And so I think that's the flexibility that the system could bring. Now, whether or not that's going to be realized is always another question.
Thank you.
Senator Begich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm bouncing in my seat here because this is a question I've been asking a number of the superintendents as they've come by and visited the office and spoken about with the Commissioner of Education. And I was referring to it as the third way. You know, there's a voc-ed component, a college component, but what about those who want to stay in the village? Two superintendents, Dr. Bolin and Superintendent Pico. Dr. Bolin from the Bering Straits School District and Superintendent Pico from the Lower Yukon School District are in fact developing this criteria to accommodate those who want to stay in the villages. You know, in places like in Bering Straits, there's, you know, 21% 50% of the population of Hooper Bay, for example, is under the age of 21. So you're talking about a substantial population boom. It's why we still have population in the state of Alaska, because while people are leaving, the growth rates in rural villages are extreme. And what these superintendents were struggling with was kids who actually wanted to stay in the village, and what do we do with that? So I've asked those superintendents and the commissioner to work together before the board finishes its planning process, instead of responding to the Board of Education's strategic plan, getting engaged in it to talk about this third way. So I think we're going to see something emerge at the earliest this summer that will you know, reach that exact question I asked them, Senator Stevens. So I'm kind of excited about it. I'm going to look at this Navajo innovation stuff, though, too. That sounds interesting. So
could I
write on Senator that? Stevens.
That's pretty fascinating, I think. And in my experience in Kodiak is that When I first arrived in 1970, there was very little knowledge of the culture of the Aleutic people. Now, kids grow up seeing the artwork, seeing the masks, and knowing the magnificent culture that preceded them that was sort of lost for centuries, really. So if nothing else, I see this, the cultural contact part of this, really enlivening those who stay in the village. They would know more about their culture than they ever did before.
Yes, and I just make the comment, too, Andrew, you brought up the possibility that learning these skills might provide the students the best of both worlds, where they could stay in the village and practice subsistence, but they also could have a great job using technology as we're connected. So pretty fascinating stuff. I don't see any other questions right now, but if you, Andrew, you said you made some notes for some of the questions that we asked Mr. LaFrance. So if you want to highlight a few of those major points that you thought might be important to add on to what we learned from Mr. LaFrance.
Oh, definitely. Okay, so let me just go down the list here real quick. So the access to other coursework, this is obviously, I think, the biggest advantage to virtual learning or digital learning. And, you know, it kind of goes back to Clay Christensen's work out of, I believe it was Harvard, right, The Disrupting Education. And that's that we're going from a situation where you have zero access to potentially a course that's only 80% as good as having a face-to-face teacher. But when you're talking about opportunities, right, that's like no opportunity to suddenly having a chance. And so I think that's kind of the important piece to think about when we're thinking about access, that sometimes even if it isn't quite as good as it could be, something is always better than nothing. And I think right now, that's sort of the challenge, that in many cases, students out in these rural areas just have nothing. The second thing, when it comes to that teacher training, there's two things I just wanted to bring up so that you're kind of aware of them. One is there's a group out of California, and they've got several other folks that are working on something called Leading Edge Certifications. It's an open educational resource. In other words, free. It's something called Creative Commons. But they've actually put together a curriculum. We're currently investigating it, where they actually have certifications that can be earned for teachers, administrators, online teachers, and professional developers, all with sort of an educational context. And that's a real powerful resource that we're kind of looking at dialing into. The others is that idea of micro-credentials. And this is something that's growing in popularity in a variety of fields, but education in particular. And that's that many times you need just in time, just in the right place, kind of professional development for something you're doing. And a micro-credential really is just some sort of competency-based check that's sort of third-party verified that you sort of get almost like a merit badge, right? Like I get my Boy Scout or Girl Scout's merit badge that I can wear that says I know how to facilitate online learning, right? And I've gone through some tiny bit of course content. That might not be as extreme as a full 3-credit course or college course, but those are something that are really popular that's coming out of digitalpromise.org. It's an organization run by Carol Cater. She was the educational technology director, I believe, a couple of years back. So those are some real interesting things that are happening in the professional development world where, you know, they're online versions of how do you get trained. Kind of moving to the level of readiness, you know, I was kind of looking through some of the research, recent research, and it kind of just keeps coming back to executive function, that students who do well in online learning have higher levels of executive function, and so that's where it kind of comes back to that idea of, like, you know, grit, perseverance, self-motivation, those types of things. And so when we're talking about that levels of readiness, there's a growing movement around sort of those executive functions and what it takes to prepare kids for that. And so I know there's a little bit of work being done around that idea of how do you quantify that or how do you qualify that. So you might have clear criteria around how ready a student would be to engage in some of those more self-motivating pieces. And then that parent piece, particularly in that sort of lower grade level, pretty much K through 8, that all the programs that I've been involved with expect a huge amount of parental involvement when they're sort of fully online or homeschooled pieces. And so that's something to consider. The cost savings piece, that's sort of an interesting one. The higher ed, the Higher Ed Chronicles just put out a study where they did some surveying, and they found that of the higher ed courses, most courses were the same cost or actually higher costs when all things were taken into consideration. That being said, the place where we saw savings in my previous district was when we were able to identify those competency-based courses. And so I won't go into the specifics of which courses there were, because that's got to kind of be a state-by-state or school-by-school decision. But there are certain courses that we really identified as being very competency-driven, and we were able to put those into an online course. We did see cost savings there. The reality of it, though, is that, you know, you've got curriculum, you've got teacher training, you've got devices, and you have bandwidth. And so some of what we saw was also a cost shift to the parents, as depending on whether or not a district provided bandwidth costs and device costs to the families that were participating, that was something that needed to be considered. And then I think just last, I think one of the things you guys touched on was that activating low-performing students. And I think this comes back to, again, usually that's about relevance. And whether or not a student's connecting with that curriculum. So I would agree with what Pete said. There are students who get very excited about it simply because it's online. There's also certain students that get turned off it simply because it's online. What's interesting is that we, in our blended learning program, found some very unique situations where different types of students actually performed very well, particularly a type of student that was on the spectrum, the autism spectrum. We found that they did exceptionally well with blended learning because they were able to sort of work at their level at different levels. So if they were in ninth grade level in math, they could be working on algebra, but at the same time they might be third grade level reading, and they could be working on that. And as we saw the frustration levels go down and the anxiety go down around those curricular approaches, that personalized learning piece really made the students much happier to be at school, much more prepared to be at school. So, yeah, the only other things I wanted to bring up was a couple areas of concern, I guess. There are things that I think we want to consider. One thing is, and this is really hard, there's a almost disappointingly low amount of data around the success of students at the K-12 level on online learning. What I mean by that is special education data. One of the things that becomes very difficult when we were running our program at Arizona statewide is who's providing special education services for online students. That became a very tricky question, and I don't think that's something that most states readily have an answer for. The same thing was there for mobility and low graduation rates. So one thing that we did see with students who started doing online, especially if they had multiple choice schools, was a struggling student or a parent who didn't want to acknowledge the difficulties they were having would hop online schools. And so they might start at one program, and as they were doing poorly, they would then try to jump to the next school. And so they kind of kept hitting the restart button over and over and over again. And what we found was that ended up really contributing to a lack of credit acquisition and then ultimately higher graduation or lower graduation rates. And so one thing that had been talked about right before I left, and I don't know what happened, was really trying to figure out if we are going that route with certain students, how are we tracking their overall success as they go from program to program? And so that'd be something else to consider.
Thank you. And that goes back, I think, to the success coach that you were talking about, too, to help that kind of situation and the counselor overall. So you went through a lot of good information rapidly. Are there any questions? Senator Stevens, Senator Begich. Senator Begich.
I, just very quickly, I wanted to be sure I understood that last point, and I think maybe suggest an answer, Andrew. But you said, I wrote down, I put, quote, student hopping. But what you're really saying there is be sure that you have a process in place so that you can track an individual student regardless of which course they might end up in, just like we would track a student moving from school district to school district, to ensure that we're not, you know, coming up with inflated graduation rates and that kind of thing because we lost track of the student, but really trying to track that student and also developing, if we move more in this direction, a tracking system for spec ed, for special ed education students specifically, to see if the outcomes are improving. Were those the two things you said?
Yeah, those are both key considerations.
Thank you. That's all I have.
Senator Stevens.
Well, thank you, Andrew. I asked Pete about what the future holds. Do you have any reflection on that? Where are we going? What can we expect in the next 20 years?
I think for me, I kind of go back to that whole idea of adaptive. I see us doing a real interesting balance between computers doing what they do well and humans doing what they do well. So there's sort of that old joke about never send a human to do a machine's job. And I think that's very true, that when it comes to a lot of sort of the rote learning, the practice and the repetition, there are actually computer systems that can do that quite well with students. They're infinitely patient, and they can give you a bunch of different ways to do that. I think where the human element comes back in is really more about, you know, learning at its core is a social activity. You're trying to learn so that you can contribute to society, you can contribute to your community. And that's something that, you know, virtual learning in and of itself, competency-based courses, is always going to struggle with. So I think you're going to see that sort of balance between, you know, certain key things that are done via computer and then certain things that really an inspired educator is going to take those students and do some things. And what that educator is and how they're certified and all that stuff, I think that's a big foggy gray area, but I do think that's going to be kind of that critical mix.
I love that line, never send a human to do a machine's job. That's, we're learning that slowly.
Senator Beckett.
Just an illustration of that, you know, I was listening today at the Planet Hunt people. That you go online and they have like 600,000 people that are doing planet searching, and when the NASA person was asked, well, why don't you just have an algorithm for this? This, they can't write one for it. Nothing compares to the human ability to see minute change. So they can't write, NASA can't write an algorithm for it. So that's why they never let send a human to do a machine's job, but also never send a machine to do a human's job.
Andrew, you mentioned competency type online education might be more apt to bring in cost savings, and I'm, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm picturing that as the individual learning where it is asynchronous. But I would like to ask you, in the model that I described with a rural school, to bring in teachers from afar, and if you're familiar with Tim Shumway and what he's doing at the Copper River School District, where he's in Anchorage and he is providing coursework for students in three different schools that otherwise would need teachers there, and if you talk to the superintendent there, she is quite certain that they are saving considerable amount, and that would not be competence-based, that would be synchronous performance-based. I guess it would be performance-based, and they have more of the traditional time span, you know, a semester for a class or whatever it might be, or year-long, and they believe that they are realizing savings. So just think about the rural model and give me your thoughts as whether you think there's potential not only for increasing the quality economically, but maybe a tad of savings possibly too. Do you think there's potential for that?
Well, I think it's an interesting question. I mean, I think it's going to depend a lot on the classified staff that's there for the students and how comfortable those instructors are with the technology. I guess the question I would be curious about would be, depending on what the course areas were, could those students do as well without that traditional sort of approach? And what I mean by that is, you know, a lot of times the real benefit of having a teacher in the classroom is that you're doing projects, that you're you know, you're interacting with peers, and in this case, you'd still be able to do that. So, I mean, it's an interesting idea. But I've also, and this has just been my experience, without seeing their coursework, it'd be hard to say anything, but I often find that when you're doing a synchronous course like that, it almost ends up on an over-reliance of direct instruction, which is really that teacher talking to the students and modeling problems on an interactive whiteboard that can be seen across multiple areas. That's where I just kind of come back to is that, I mean, there's times when direct instruction is extremely important, but there's also times when you want to move beyond that. And so, again, that'd be kind of my question is are we going to end up in a spot where we're promoting more direct instruction simply because of the limitation of the technology tools and how that looks? So, I think that's the big, it kind of just comes back to outcomes. What are we hoping for those students to be able to do with the knowledge when they're done, and what's the best way to get there?
Well, thank you for that, and I encourage you, you might want to check out what Mr. Shumway is doing, because he is using some interactive tools. It's not just direct instruction. It's pretty fascinating what he's doing. So if there are no other questions, I just want to, and I'm not seeing any, so Andrew, I just want to thank you very much, and thank you too to Pete LaFrance, if he's still listening in. We have learned a lot, and hearing from people that are actually out there doing it is extremely helpful as we look at whether this is something we want to move forward in our state. So thank you so much, Andrew. And with that, I will announce to our members that our next meeting will be Wednesday at 8 a.m., March 1st, and we'll be hearing from the department about student academic results in our state. So that will be... will that be in this room? Yes, that's right. We are not just I know we've had a lot of joint meetings, so I'll just mention they are scheduled out this week. They're going to join us next Monday. Commonwealth North, Mark Foster will be presenting to us their recommendations. So they'll be back with us next Monday. So this week we will be in this room. And thank you so much, everyone, for being here. And we will adjourn at 9:17.